It is Thursday, November 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, 12 people are killed by a gunman at a California nightclub.
He turned to the right and shot several of the other security and employees there, and then began opening fire inside the nightclub.
The United Nations says more than 200 mass graves have been found in Iraqi territory formerly occupied by Islamic State, and a Virginia museum showcases medicines from the past. It's all ahead. Authorities have identified the gunman who killed 12 people late Wednesday during an attack at a Southern California bar and dance club as Ian David Long. Eyewitnesses described a scene of chaos as shots rang out in the dance club and patrons scrambled to seek cover and escape. Ventura County Sheriff Jeff Dean told reporters about what's known about how the shooting spree began.
It appears he walked up to the scene. He shot the security guard that was standing outside. He stepped inside. It appears that he turned to the right and shot several of the other security and employees there, and then began opening fire inside the nightclub.
Dean said Long had been in the U.S. Marine Corps.
I understand that was part of the discussion when the deputies went out to the call with the crisis team, that felt he might be suffering from PTSD, basing that the fact he was a veteran and had been in the Corps.
VOA's Wayne Lee tells me about the attack on the Borderline Bar and Grill in the city of Thousand Oaks.
Police have apprehended a 29-year-old man by the name of Ian David Long, and he is a resident of Thousand Oaks, California. And late Wednesday night, he entered a nightclub in Thousand Oaks and started shooting immediately after entering the establishment. 12 people were killed, and he was also found dead after police entered the nightclub. Police believe that he shot himself, because once they re-entered the facility or the nightclub, he was already dead, and they believe, but have not confirmed, that he took his own life.
And apparently a policeman was shot as well.
Yeah, and he was a 29-year veteran by the name of Ron Halas. He was a sergeant, and unfortunately, reports say he was only 1 year away from retirement, so that certainly was, any death is a tragedy, but this one particularly so, in light of the fact that he was so close to retirement and of course had loved ones. His wife said that he died as a hero.
Is it known why Long did this?
Ventura County Sheriff Jeff Dean said a motive had not been determined at the time that he spoke. Dean spoke with reporters Thursday morning. But he did say that Long apparently had some issues. He had a few minor run-ins with law enforcement in recent years, including traffic stops. Also, police officers were called to his home in April. And according to the authorities, he was acting somewhat irate, a little irrationally. And Sheriff Dean said that mental health experts spoke with Long at the time, but they felt he was not qualified to be detained under California law.
Have the names of the victims, other than the police officer, been identified yet?
No. In fact, the number of people have been injured hasn't even been determined as well, because they were, of course, taken to area hospitals and are being treated. So it's still early in the investigation, and I'm sure more details will be coming out in the coming hours.
That's VOA's Wayne Lee. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The Taliban and the United States will join a Russia-hosted conference for the first time. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been hospitalized after fracturing her ribs. And Seoul says North Korea asked for the postponement of a meeting between U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and North Korean officials. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
Science in a Minute.
A trio of astronomers have discovered a star they say could be one of the oldest stars in the universe. They say at 13.5 billion years old, this low-mass star's body is mostly made up of just the elements created by the Big Bang merely 300 million years earlier. At its birth, scientists say only three elements, mostly hydrogen, helium, and a small amount of lithium, made up the universe. Elements heavier than the first three were created when the early stars exploded in supernovas. With each successive generation of stars, even more heavier elements, including gold and platinum, were created. The astronomers say it was unusual to find an ancient low-metal star in the same part of the Milky Way where our sun resides in. The oldest stars have been mostly found near the center of our galaxy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, world leaders meet this weekend to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the end of World War, and a historian talks to us about the war's causes. United Nations investigators have found more than 200 mass graves containing thousands of human remains in territory formerly controlled by the Islamic State militants in Iraq. The UN representative in Iraq, Jan Kubis, urged Iraqi authorities to excavate the graves to provide closure for their families. Experts say these mass graves could provide forensic evidence of war crimes. VOA's Middle East analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi asked Belkis Villi, senior Iraq researcher at Human Rights Watch, what needs to be done with this new discovery.
As the report has shown, and in line with many reports we've written over the years, in the wake of the period where ISIS was controlling territory in Iraq and Syria, as well as in the context of fighting by Iraqi forces to retake territory, you have seen mass graves appear across areas in Syria and Iraq. And unfortunately, in the context of Iraq, what we have seen is that years after ISIS has left control of these areas, almost nothing has been done to exhume the mass grave sites. And as long as these sites are not exhumed, it means that the very serious evidence in the ground, evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity that were committed, will never be able to be used in trials, in proper criminal proceedings that really are trying to get at accountability for these horrific abuses. The other reality is that as long as these mass grave sites are not exhumed, family members, thousands of families across Iraq who still have loved ones missing, who they think might still be alive, perhaps taken by ISIS across the border into Syria or elsewhere, these families won't be able to get closure because they'll continue to hope that their loved ones are still alive. And for them to come to terms with the loss of their loved ones, they're going to need to know where they're buried and where they lie.
If these mass graves could provide forensic evidence of war crimes, what happens after that?
Well, in the context of Iraq, you have a functioning judicial system. You have judges who not only are willing to prosecute ISIS suspects for crimes committed, but are indeed doing that. The problems that we see, though, in Iraq with these prosecutions are manifold. And one major problem being that crimes that we're talking about, war crimes, crimes against humanity, possibly genocide, these crimes actually don't exist in Iraq's penal code. So instead, the worst cases of prosecutions are only being addressed under Iraq's counterterrorism law, and no individual across Iraq, no ISIS suspect has actually been prosecuted for committing a specific war crime, a specific killing, or indeed committing something like sex slavery, rape of women.
What role could Human Rights Watch play to make sure that these victims are getting the required attention and to secure justice for their families?
Our role as Human Rights Watch is, first and foremost, to document at the time that the abuses are happening. So we spent years documenting these abuses by ISIS and creation of these mass grave sites. But now the work in Iraq is to make sure that prosecutions are proceeding in line with international standards, prosecutions that include real evidence, evidence of crimes that were committed, and that evidence is really most likely going to be found in these mass grave sites. So as an organization, with the reports that we write and the recommendations that we make, we continue to be urging Iraqi authorities and indeed all other governments that are supporting the Iraqi government at this time to prioritize proper prosecutions and a proper accountability process for the abuses by ISIS.
Belkis Villi, senior Iraq researcher at Human Rights Watch. The political landscape shifted in Washington this week in the wake of the 2018 congressional midterm elections. Opposition Democrats won back control of the House of Representatives, while Republicans expanded their majority in the Senate. The election returns amounted to what many see as a split midterm verdict on Donald Trump's presidency, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
At the White House, President Trump talked up the possibility of working with Democrats now that they will control the House.
I would like to see bipartisanship. I'd like to see unity. And I think we have a very good chance of, and maybe not on everything, but I think we have a very good chance of seeing that.
Trump also took credit for Republican gains in the Senate.
Well, I think the results that I've learned and maybe confirmed, I think people like me. I think people like the job I'm doing, frankly.
House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi left the door open to working with Trump on health care and other issues.
We will strive for bipartisanship. We believe that we have a responsibility to seek common ground where we can. Where we cannot, we must stand our ground.
Democrats were happy with taking the House, but disappointed with the poor showing in Senate races. Former Congressman Patrick Murphy appeared on VOA's Plugged In.
Not nearly as big of a wave as I was expecting or a lot of other Democrats out there. And I think this really shows it is less about the issues and more about Donald Trump.
In the wake of Tuesday's election, the political path forward in Washington is uncertain, says Washington Post analyst Karen Tumulty.
It's really a mixed verdict here. It's like the blue wave met the red wall. And I think that it's, as a result, probably going to be pretty difficult for our allies around the world to figure out what's going on, other than, you know, probably a lot of gridlock out of Congress.
Some cooperation between Trump and the Democrats is possible, says John Fortier.
There will be things that can get done, but they will require both the cooperation of Democrats and Republicans, which is hard because they're far apart, but still possible to do some things, but not the Trump agenda.
But the president could back away if Democrats launch oversight investigations of the White House, says Molly O'Rourke.
Life will be very different in the Trump White House with a Democratic Congress that has the ability to challenge him in terms of his legislative agenda, but also in terms of the way the administration is being run.
In the wake of the midterms, President Trump appears both embattled and emboldened politically, and already looking ahead to what promises to be an intense re-election fight 2 years from now. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Dozens of world leaders gather in Paris Sunday to mark the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, a four-year conflict that left millions dead, wounded, widowed, and orphaned. World War I ushered in new technologies, gave impetus to the rise of communism, introduced poison gas on a large scale, and redrew the map of Europe. The guns fell silent in an armistice on November 11, 1918, 100 years ago Sunday. The Treaty of Versailles in 1920 officially ended hostilities. Michael Borah, a retired military officer, is a professor of military history at the Royal Military College of Canada in Kingston, Ontario. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the so-called Great War was a mistake, started by accident in the summer of 1914 while Europe's leaders were on vacation. He said given the lack of modern communications, French and German mobilization made the war inevitable, affecting not just military personnel, but also civilians.
First of all, in the military sphere, this is a war like no other. It's a war of great technology. It's a total war in that not only are armies, navies, and now air forces brought to bear against one's opponents, but now the entire population of a country is involved, either through military service or through the great and terrible industrial war that was fought to simply to outproduce the opponent. Now, the French have a very unique experience of the war because the French are motivated in great part by hatred. The Germans have already seized, many years before, in 1870, 71, two of the largest departments in France, two of the largest provinces, Alsace and Lorraine. So the hatred which motivates the French soldiers all through the war is visceral, and it tends to create casualties because there's no holding the French back. The Germans, of course, are reacting according to a plan brought forward by the General Staff in order to attack westward towards France and then eastward towards Russia to, in fact, establish themselves as the masters of Europe with a view to world domination.
This was a truly mechanized conflict. Some would argue that the machines outpaced the tactics, and that's why you had so many casualties.
The internal combustion engine powers the vehicle, makes the truck possible, and makes the tank possible. And if you look at what airplanes looked like in 1914 and what they looked like 4 years later, there was an enormous technological push. For my money, the most important piece of the technological advance, if you will, is in the medical field. We learned about taking care of people who are in deep shock. We learned to transfuse blood. Very complicated operations are made possible through sheer practice. And the care industry comes into its own because, of course, not only are many, many people killed in this great war, but there are enormous numbers of handicapped people who must live with these traces of war for the rest of their days.
As world leaders gather in Paris to mark the 100th anniversary of the end of the so-called Great War, what is the message today about this conflict?
For me, as an observer, as an historian, it can happen again. There is a convergence of confusion and a conversion of instability throughout the world. And we see this now with the advent, if you will, or the rebirth of fascism, the rebirth of nationalism, the rebirth of unstable societies who are becoming completely taken up by the advance of their own identity. We play the identity game at risk to ourselves, and this game is being played throughout the world. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second that another great conflagration is around the corner. What I am suggesting is that some of the conditions are coming together to increase instability to the point, just like in 1914, where an accident can happen.
And Michael Bora said he's not just speaking about the use of weapons of mass destruction, but the threat that 9/11-style terrorist attacks might become commonplace. That, he said, could result in global instability, with nations lashing out for their own survival. He said that is where his worries grow. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is International Edition. Dragon's blood, mandrake root, and devil's snare were used for potions and spells in the Harry Potter series. But in real life, the creepy name plants were used for medicinal purposes and could be purchased at an apothecary, also called a pharmacy. Today, the best-preserved apothecary in the United States has been turned into a small museum in historic Alexandria, Virginia. As we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, the museum provides a fascinating glimpse of medicines that were used in the past.
For more than 140 years, from the late 1700s to the 1930s, the family-owned Stabler Leadbeater Apothecary served customers with an amazing assortment of medicines. When the shop closed, the building's new owner kept it just the way it was and turned it into a museum, says manager Lauren Gleason.
A lot of the medicines that people would have been purchasing here were probably for minor ailments, rashes, skin conditions, the flu, a headache.
The Apothecary Museum contains thousands of items. They include bloodletting tools and cobalt glass bottles to store poisonous liquids. Like a modern drugstore, the Apothecary sold more than just medicine.
Lots of other chemicals like paints and dyes and perfumes would have been made and sold here, but other items like sewing machines and pens and razors and baby bottles were sold here as well.
On the store's original shelves are dozens of gold leaf labeled hand-blown glass bottles for liquids.
These bottles have probably been part of this pharmacy's collection since the 1850s.
A number of them have traces of residue from the ingredients. Others, amazingly, still contain liquids that go back decades, including cinnamon for nausea, iodine, an antiseptic, and opium, which is derived from the poppy flower.
Opium was a very effective painkiller, and it would often be used to treat the flu or dysentery.
The upstairs room looks like something out of a Harry Potter movie, with its old wooden boxes and drawers for storing herbs and other botanicals. Aconite, or wolfsbane, was a topical pain reliever, but in the wizardly world, the plant helps control violence by werewolves during their full moon transformations, explains Jim Williams, a tour guide.
So if you have werewolf trouble, it gets you through to the next full moon. But the practical use was for gout and joint pain.
And then there's dragon's blood, used for making potions in the Potter series. But dragon's blood actually comes from a tree, whose red resin was mostly used as a varnish. Visitor Christine Zapata from California is intrigued by the variety of plants, which include cannabis, the marijuana plant.
Using all these different herbs and, like, you know, plant-based medicines that are, like, coming back now, and, like, people are, you know, more into the holistic. So for me, that's personally most interesting to me because I work in the cannabis industry.
While some medicines were discarded after it was known they were toxic, we still rely on others for today's modern remedies. Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
A look at medicines of the past and sometimes the present. Well, that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.